This is Deanna Dawkins with the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, and I'm lucky enough today to be interviewing my granddad, Donald Dawkins, a veteran of World War II. My granddad has been kind enough to have me over to his home in Orlando, Florida, this Sunday, March 13th, 2011. Thanks for taking the time to let me interview you, granddad.
Actually, it's Winter Park we live in.
Oh, Winter Park, sorry. Well, it's technically still Orlando. All right. Well, I guess can we start out, can you tell us a little bit about your life growing up, where you were born?
I was born in Brooklyn, a city my mother hated. And I guess I left there when I went in the service. And I moved around in the service for 2-3 years, including overseas. Overseas, I was in England, I guess, in Scotland and France mostly. And I ended up in infantry division, the Yankee division, which was a National Guard division from Massachusetts. Okay. That's where it got the name Yankee. And we were assigned to Patton's Third Army. And Patton used my division, 26th, quite a lot in his campaign. And it's pretty clear that he called on the 26th Division and the 90th Division. That was his other favorite, although he really favored the armored divisions because they had tanks.
Oh.
And but he had to have some infantry divisions. He had at least two, and I was in one of them.
Okay. What were your opinions about the war before you got involved?
Oh, well, it was quite simple. The Russians call World War II the Great Patriotic War. That's their name for it.
Yeah.
Their official name. The Great. And we could have had that same name because we had the same feelings toward the Germans and the Japanese that the Russians had, you know, for the Germans. You know, we were attacked by the Japanese, and the Germans declared war a couple of days later. They didn't have to, but they got swept away.
Yeah.
Enthusiasm. They had a pact with Japan, but it was carefully worded so that they didn't have to automatically go to war if Japan did.
Mm-hmm.
But they did anyway.
So what was your education like before entering the service? Or did you go to college at all, or did you go straight into the service?
I was in college. We knew there was going to be a war when I was in high school. I went to a military high school. Mm-hmm. Jesuits, they were very smart people. They knew there was going to be a war. They used to tease us. They called us cannon fodder.
Oh, no.
It was also a military high school. It had a ROTC unit. And I got to be a captain, you know, when I was a senior in that ROTC unit.
So did you always know that you wanted to go into the military?
Well, I knew that we were going to be at war. I mean, just poor FDR had to keep saying that. That we would not be in the war, but it was obvious that we couldn't escape the war.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese solved our problem
yeah.
by attacking us. But before that, you know, we couldn't fight because the president has to declare war, and he couldn't do that without the consent of the Congress, and there was no consent until we were attacked. There were, you know, different factions. Some help Bundles for Britain, help Britain, and others, America first, stay out of it, you know, let them fight their European battles themselves, you know. Because we got very cynical from World War I being dragged into World War I.
Yeah.
So there was a... But the, the Japanese solved our problem by attacking us, and immediately, very patriotic fervor came like a fire throughout the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even little things like there was a radio program, The Green Hornet, and The Green Hornet was a big crime fighter, you know, and he had a faithful Japanese valet, Kato, who was immediately changed to a faithful Filipino.
Oh my gosh, I never knew that.
Oh yeah, all these sorts of things happen. We really had very bad feelings toward Japan. Mm. And before that, well, they were always throwing their weight around, beating up on poor China, and they were not liked. They were rude, kind of pushy, and ruthless. But when they attacked us, that was the straw, the last straw.
Yeah.
And they were despised. The Japanese were despised in the U.S. In fact, look what we did to the poor buggers, the civilians. We moved them out of California, stuck them in the desert. And still try to live that down.
Oh, my gosh.
But at the time, it was great, you know. Too bad we can't make them go further away. These were citizens.
Yeah.
Poor buggers.
Well, you said there was an upsurge of patriotism. Did any of your friends enlist? I mean, was it something everyone was doing?
Everybody, yes. Everybody. The worst fear we had, like we were 17, 18 years old, the worst fear we had was being a 4F. 4F means you fail the army physical. The government didn't want you because you failed the physical. And being a 4F was a mark of shame. We had a 4F lived next door, and a poor guy was crushed. And what they could do, though, they could join the Merchant Marine. You know, they just wanted bodies, you know. They didn't care whether you met the physical standards. So, or they could find maybe other ways to participate in the war, but they couldn't be in the Navy or Army or Air Force if they failed the physical. But everybody wanted to serve. No exceptions.
Okay. So how much time passed after you enlisted before you began training?
Well, see, I enlisted first in 1942, when I was just a freshman in college. But I wasn't called up right away. But all the kids in college were enlisting. Mm-hmm. And you held up your hand and you were sworn in, then you were at the Army's disposal. But they didn't call me up until, I think it was March 43, that's when I was called into the Army. But I did enlist. I was never drafted.
Okay. When you finally began training, where did you train and what types of things did you do?
Well, I didn't have regular basic training at first, just some, little stuff, but not the real basic training. I didn't get that until I was assigned to the infantry. But the first thing I did was, I was assigned to the Air Force. All the college kids were going in the Air Force. The thing I dreaded and feared, as I said in my memoir, was going in the infantry. I didn't want any part of that. And fate plays tricks on you. That's where I ended up, despite my best efforts. I did a stupid thing. Instead of letting well enough alone and staying in the Air Force, I signed up for this specialized training program where the Army sent you back to college. You were a soldier, but you went to college. And they fooled with that for a year or so. And then they realized that they're not going to win the war with soldiers going to school. The Germans, were tough people to fight. So they abolished it, and they put us all in the infantry.
Oh, no.
they own your soul, you know. they just do with you whatever they want to do. You really have no rights at all. And it's still that way. That's the way the Army is.
So when you were deployed, where did you go first?
I know. Atlantic City.
Atlantic City?
Went to Atlantic. Well, see, all the hotels were taken over by the Air Force.
Oh, really?
In Atlantic City. Kicked all the civilians out. Wow. And Atlantic City, see, the whole country mobilized because we had two big enemies, Germany and Japan. Italy, too, but they didn't count. But Germany and Japan were scary. So the Air Force took over Atlantic City, all the big hotels, you know, big palatial, picked all the civilians out. I don't know where the hell they went. And they put us rookie soldiers in them, and we trained on the beach there at Atlantic City when I was in the Air Force, diddling around, marching and stuff. The Army never lets you alone. You're always doing something, usually marching. But we didn't learn anything about combat in the Air Force. But then when I put in for this college program, when the Army decided they weren't going to win the war with people in school, that's when I got my faith, when I got put in the infantry. Then I had real basic training, real stuff, you know, real like the going on a field under machine gun fire and crawling, and they tell you if you stand up, you'll be dead.
Wow.
So they teach you things like that.
So even in training, they were shooting real machine guns at you.
Oh, yeah. You know, but it was done carefully, and if you did what they said, you were safe. But if you forgot where you were at and stood up or crouched up high, you'd be shot.
Oh, man. Did that ever happen to people?
She's way behind. I don't know what she wants.
My grandfather took his compulsory military training in France in the Navy. When the war came, he stuck him in the Army. He was told, he stood up in the trenches, and that's how he was killed. Oh, 1915, in the first year of the war, right? In the fort. But there he said, if you stood up, you were dead.
It happened
to my own grandfather.
There were no trenches.
Which I obviously never knew. He died in 1915.
There were no trenches in the Second War.
Just to reinforce what he just said.
Oh. Okay. So when you finally made it to Europe, where were you, and what was your mission? After
my mission was to do what I was told, unquestioningly. Let's see. I spent, I guess, almost a year in this school program, and then they abolished it, and then they put us in the infantry on Tennessee maneuvers. We joined the Yankee Division in Tennessee in the mud and rain on maneuvers because the Yankee Division was going to go overseas. And then we trained in South Carolina and in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and country roads, you know, marching and stuff. And rifle range training, bayonet training. In fact, one time we were having bayonet training, and they teach you how to thrust with the bayonet and all that stuff. And there was a break for lunch, and we were lined up in rows in front of the mess tent with our mess kits. Waiting to go in to eat. And a friend of mine, Moose, these pictures up there, came in late, and he was walking down the line. And everybody, you know, looking at him, you know, where the hell's he going? He should have gotten the end of the line, but he's walking down a line all of his own, heading toward the the food area, and then he noticed that everybody was looking at him, and he made believe he had a bayonet, and he used his mess kit. He leaped, held out the spoon and stuff. Everybody busted out laughing. He made fun of the training.
Oh, God.
The bayonet training, which, by the way, we never used because everybody hated the idea of fighting with a bayonet.
Yeah.
I mean, bad enough shooting people, but sticking them with a bayonet is gruesome. So we never used the thing, but we did have training in it.
Wow. God. So when you made it, you were stationed where? You were in Lorraine, right?
Well, when we went overseas, we went directly to France. We didn't go to England. We were the first division that just went right from the U.S., from Camp Shanks, which is the port of embarkation, to France. We landed in one of those French harbors, like Brest or something. And then we did some training in France, and then we joined the Yankee Division, and we went into combat. When Patton had a race through France in 1943, and he ran out of gas, and he was bogged down, and that's when we joined him, when he was stationary.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 1944, I guess, by then. The Germans were still fighting hard, but they were retreating. So one bad thing about that is they always know where you are, because they've been there before they left, you know.
Yeah.
So they were zeroed in, you know, that's it. Means they could fire and know where the shells would land and stuff like that. So they always had that advantage. Is that what you wanted to know?
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about your day-to-day life in the Army? Kind of what...
You mean when I was a real soldier?
Yeah, when you were...
Okay. Well, you live in holes. Soldiers live in holes. And... you dig a foxhole. Well, they call them foxholes, but they were really slit trenches because you can't lie down in a foxhole. You have to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
So we dug slit trenches, which you lay down in, and you could stick your head up and peer over them. And you'd sleep. You would sleep in them, and you would fight in them. If you were in a stationary position, you know, fire your rifle. So what we did, we'd be stationary for a while, maybe a couple of weeks in the same hole, and then they'd want us to move forward more. So then we'd have to attack, and sometimes the Germans would retreat, sometimes they'd fight us and wouldn't let us do it. And that, it was a kind of a hopscotch like that. Pausing and digging your hole and fighting out of it and being careful. And there's always two men in a hole. And you're never supposed to both go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one had to always be awake at night. So what we did was fight out of our holes, you know, and kept doing that. And the weather gradually got worse. We started fighting like in September or so. And then the damn rain started, the cold rain, then snow.
Mm-hmm.
And always outside. And that's when I started to get frostbite.
Yeah.
I was susceptible to it, much more so than the ordinary, the other guys. I was prone to get it. I even got it in the States, in maneuvers in the States.
Wow.
Trench foot, they called it. It's a form of frostbite. So I knew I was going to get it, and I did. And eventually I ended up, I was the last man left in our platoon. The platoon is 38 men, and the others have all been killed or wounded. And I was the last one left.
Wow.
In that platoon, yeah. And then I couldn't walk anymore. And that's when I, you know, went to the medics, and then they took very good care of me. Mm-hmm. But the damage was done, you know.
Yeah.
I got the gangrene, frostbite and gangrene. And gangrene's dangerous because it spreads.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not arrested, and they came out with penicillin just in time. That was discovered, I think, 1938 or so. Sir Alexander Fleming. And that saved a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because they gave you penicillin to keep the infection from spreading.
Yeah. Well, I know in your memoirs you detail the experiences in the hospitals, you know, when you were there for your frostbite and gangrene, experiences such as the German POWs and the enormous needles that they were using for the experimentation with halting or reversing the frostbite. Could you recount some of those experiences?
Oh, God. Well, they had a problem with the frostbite. Some, and really it was because we had such crummy equipment. We had a good rifle. But the Germans had boots. We had high shoes, you know, that absorb water, and we didn't have enough socks, so our feet were always wet. And the army couldn't cope with that. They never developed proper foot. Well, eventually, they did develop proper footwear, but typical army, the rear echelon troops got them.
Wow.
Everything's backwards in the army, not in the German army. I put that in my memoir. In the German army, the frontline troops got everything first, and things trickled back to the rear echelon. American army was lazy. The rear echelon got everything first, and things trickled up to the fighting soldiers.
Wow.
So we had high shoes in the clowns in the rear. There were 10 of them for every one of us. They got shoe packs and different boots and things that we didn't have.
Wow.
This army laziness, really what it was.
Well, so were there any particular missions or assignments that stand out in your mind?
Oh, I had a guard, the colonel, once during an attack that was sort of a left-handed honor.
Yeah.
But we were attacking through woods, and myself and another guy were with the colonel of the regiment. And he was urging the troops forward. I put that in my memoir. So that was like an assignment. But oh, and the other thing is, I was a scout, and that was, I shouldn't have let myself be a scout, but I was the second scout. A squad had 12 men, and the first two were scouts, first scout, second scout. The first scout was killed in the first attack we made, shot right in the head, because the scout is supposed to draw enemy fire, that's his mission.
Mm-hmm.
Like a punching bag. Terrible. But I was the second scout, so I was just almost killed, but not really hurt. In the initial days of combat. And eventually, I got to be acting squad leader.
Wow.
Just through attrition. 12 men in a squad, but there'd be about six or seven. And it was never full strength. We get replacements. I put that in my memoir. Guys too old, you know, older than 19 or 20, pictures of their wives and children. I used to hate that.
Yeah.
See that. Because they could get killed just as easily as me.
What was the greatest display of bravery by either yourself or your comrades that you can remember?
Oh, my friend Jimmy Dowers brought morphine to injured soldiers who had been shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was dangerous because he said the Germans were very fair fighters. They behaved correctly. But he went to help these wounded soldiers, he told me later. And the Germans shot at him when he was moving forward by himself. And he took his rifle and threw it on the ground so they would realize he wasn't aiming to shoot anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they left him alone when he did that.
Wow.
And that's how he administered morphine to soldiers who had been shot in a failed attack. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Like that? Your friend Jimmy, I know that you mentioned a story about him and a Tommy gun. What was that?
Well, he was a very resourceful guy. He didn't just hang around with where he belonged. He'd wander off by himself. and he'd have little adventures. I would never do that. I always stayed with my comrades. I didn't want to be by myself.
Yeah.
God, the thought would have horrified me. But he did. And he ran into some tankers, and they had Tommy guns. The tankers. And he made friends with them, and they gave him a Tommy gun. That's how he got it.
Oh, my gosh.
And he used it. He killed Germans with it.
Wow. Also, one of the stories about him that stood out was after the war, when you guys were in a bar or something, and he got carded and...
Yeah. His miniature little copy of his Silver Star citation. He got the Silver Star.
Wow.
For what he did for the wounded soldiers, giving them morphine. He didn't have to do. He wasn't a medic, mm-hmm. but he scrounged morphine, and he went to them under fire till the Germans realized what he was doing, and they didn't do it fire anymore.
Wow. So when you were in the war and you were fighting, did you feel like you were making an impact?
Yeah. Yeah, you realize, you know, the only way you can win the war is to kill German soldiers, kill them or disable them. So they had to go back to hospital. So we knew, you know, that we were really deciding the war's outcome
mm-hmm.
by our actions. It wasn't like these poor buggers in Vietnam, you know, what the, you know, suppose they kill somebody in pajamas fighting them. What does that mean, you know? How is the world better for that?
Yeah.
But we were trying to kill German soldiers because they were, you know, representing this horrible government
mm-hmm.
that Germany had, slaughtering people and stuff.
What did you miss most about home?
You mean about not being home, you mean?
Or like anything, you know, from home.
Oh, it was, you hardly ever thought about home. It was a different world.
Mm-hmm.
You were in a different world in combat. And, you know, you could be killed any time. You know, safety was... Not a guarantee. You know, it was dangerous where we were all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were even freak accidents could kill you.
What do you mean by freak accidents?
Accidentally getting shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were some self-inflicted wounds, though, deliberate. To avoid combat.
Really?
Disgraceful. Yeah. I saw a guy do it.
Really?
Shot himself in the hand. People usually shot themselves in the foot. He was different. He shot himself in the hand.
Just so he didn't have to fight.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's obvious what he did.
Yeah.
You know.
In your memoirs, you described the craze over the chocolate in the K rations. Could you kind of tell us a little about that?
You know, you get enough to eat. The K rations were very cleverly designed. They had breakfast, they had lunch, and they had dinner. And it was like a Cracker Jack box with the wax, you know, paper. And they were good. And some of the damn food was like a delicacy, like the patty de foie gras, whatever that is, the French thing. We had those were little cans with a key you opened. And that's a gourmet food, you know. Some of them had franks and beans. The food was pretty good. But you never got enough sugar. And one of the sadistic things I always thought, they gave you something they called a D-bar. It was an emergency ration. Every now and then, the D-bar would show up in a K-ration package, and you're supposed to save that for when you ran out of food. If you had no food, you ate this emergency ration of D-bar. It was chocolate. So everybody said, boy, this is great. But it was a special kind of chocolate that they neutered it in some way so that it wasn't sweet. It was like eating wax. But it was chocolate. Every now and then you get a little taste. And you realize that you're eating chocolate, but you didn't really want the damn thing.
Yeah.
Typical army, you know. Of course, they had to do that. They couldn't put something delicious in a cake, you know, because the soldiers would eat it up right away. The other thing is the incident. Soldiers never get any sugar, so they're always, you know, looking for chocolate or anything like that. So one time we got a box of chocolates came around. Like they were like, they weren't the big nickel bars, but they were about half that size. And they were distributed throughout the company. And we were in pup tents, I remember at this time, when we got these. And it was unusual. We only got them once, but people would steal them. They were so good. They were the real chocolate, you know, you get in the store. And people would fight over them and yell and scream. They were stolen. They're grown men, you know what I mean, fighting over chocolate bars this big.
God. As far as the age of the men, I know one of your pet peeves in war movies is that the actors are always so much older than were in reality.
Yeah.
So what was the age range?
Soldiers are boys, you know. They're the age of 19 and 20. Most soldiers are 19 and 20. I was 20 when I got into combat. So I would say, you know, and there were probably some even 17, but the main age was 18, 19, 20. That's the typical age for soldiers.
Wow.
Very young, full of endurance, you know, and ability to withstand hardships. And you're at your physical peak when you're that young. And you know, if a soldier got to be past 25, he'd be called Pop.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So did you ever have any free time at all? I mean, like, I know you're, like, under fire, but were there ever situations where you weren't?
No, you never had any free time because you never saw any civilians, for example, except by accident, maybe for 5 minutes. So and there was nothing you could do. Nothing, you know, you couldn't go to a movie or read a book or do anything like that. You were just in almost a constant state of alertness. So you had no other interest. Your interest was to try to stay alive. That was your main goal, really.
Yeah. Did you ever write home? I mean, did you ever have time to write
home?
Yeah,
because they had a thing called V-mail. And you'd write on a little, they gave you like a little pad to write on a letter. And then they would photograph it and make it a tiny thing and send it back to the States. And then at the other end, they'd blow it up into regular size. And I wrote home whenever I could, but I never could tell the truth.
I just made up
stories. My poor mother was a wreck. You know, she realized, she knew I was in Patton's Third Army. That was in the paper all the time. And they let us say that in letters. So I said that I told them I was in Patton's Third Army. So she knew about that. She knew I was in danger. I was the only son. So she was a wreck to a war worrying that I would be killed.
Did she ever get any letters that were blacked out at all? Because I know censorship was big.
Isn't that a funny thing about my dysfunctional family? I don't have a single scrap of anything I ever sent home. I don't know what they did with the letters after they read them, threw them out. I would like to have one, you know, it'd be a nice souvenir. But I've never seen anything. That's the only thing I ever sent home was the occasional letter. No trophies.
Yeah.
I mean, that a little bit of that was done, but I never could figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Well, obviously, World War II was a brutal war. I mean, was there a constant atmosphere of fear? Did people have hope or confidence, or were they just mostly afraid?
As I said in my memoir, the bad thing about the infantry is there's no end, you know. You didn't go back for a rest. Maybe for one or two days, you'd go back. You'd be back with the artillery, resting, and where the big guns were shooting. So there was not a lot of hope. The other parts of the service had hope for so many flights. You know, you go home. And, so many trips, you get something else, but infantry soldiers never got anything. Just a treadmill to oblivion.
God. How was it adapting to normal life after the war?
That wasn't hard. That wasn't hard. The only thing, and I still do it, I jump at sounds. And my poor mother, she come to wake me up in the morning and try to do it gently, and I leap up in bed.
Oh, no.
Say, oh, Donald. Yeah. I still jump at sounds.
Yeah. I remember reading in your memoir that your father took you home from the hospital on VJ Day. Was it strange that your story kind of ended the same time the war did?
It was strange because we went right through the middle of New York City. Because I was in the hospital in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. He drove out there to pick me up when I was discharged. And we went right through New York City.
Wow. And
there were people celebrating and waving at
us. Wow. Do you think they knew that you were a soldier?
Oh, yeah, I was in uniform.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. How do you feel like the war changed you? I mean, besides jumping whenever you hear loud noise.
Oh, it made me kind of fatalistic. You know, fatalistic. When your time comes, you gotta go. You know, you don't know when it'll be. Mm. You could live a long time or not very long. You don't know, so just go with the flow. Try to be happy and not cause any trouble. You know, live. You know.
But, yeah. What are some of the misconceptions that we have about World War II?
Well, the dopey Hollywood movies, you know, they would play up army life like it's one big frat party, you know. And everybody's too old anyway in a damn movie that's 35 years old. They'd be ancient as soldiers at that age. You can't keep up. Yeah. You're too old in your 30s. So, Hollywood, just, I think they might not have, I'm trying to think of one proper war movie they made. I don't think of any. They're all fake.
Wow.
It's unrealistic. Once in a while, they have one with a few little scenes, like the story of G.I. Joe wasn't too bad. That was about Ernie Pyle. His adventures, you know, he was a correspondent with the troops, a beloved guy. I'll show you something. He wrote a famous column that I cut out. It's celebrated. It's the best thing he ever did. It's in here somewhere. In this drawer, I know that.
Is this it?
Sloppy drawer. Looks like it. Fame column. Yeah. Read that. It's very touching.
Ernie Pyle's most famous column concerned the death of infantry captain Henry Wasco, who was exceptionally popular with his men. His body was brought down a mountainside by mule and laid next to four others. Quote, "The men in the road seemed reluctant to leave. One soldier came down and looked down, and he said out loud, 'God damn it,' that's all he said, and then he walked away. Then a soldier came and stood beside the officer and bent over, and he too spoke to his dead captain, not in a whisper, but awfully tenderly, and he said, 'I sure am sorry, sir.' Then the first man squatted down, and he reached down and took the dead hand in his own. He sat there for a full 5 minutes, looking intently into the dead face, and he never uttered a sound all the time he sat there. And finally, he put the hand down and then reached up and gently straightened the points of the captain's shirt collar, and then he sort of rearranged the tattered edges of the uniform around the wound, and then he got up and walked away down the road in the moonlight, all alone." End quote. Italy, January 10th, 1944. Wow. That's intense.
You want a copy of that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'd fill up if you don't want to let you see that.
Wow. So it was like that then?
Yeah, there were little things like that. Yeah.
Wow.
There's something about combat that's... It's ennobling in a way, the comradeship.
Mm-hmm.
It's very close. And you can't experience it in any other way but being in combat. It's peculiar to combat.
Mm-hmm.
Dependence on other soldiers. And that little story about the dead captain was so famous when he wrote that.
Mm. Mm. Did you ever have any experiences like that with your own friends?
I was the second scout. The first scout was a friend of mine. His name was Francis Collins. He was married, but same age as me. And he was from Maine. He had a friend who was from Maine who was not in our platoon, but he was in the same company. So whenever we come back from off the line, this friend of his from Maine would come over looking for his friend. His name was Collins. And Collins got killed, and we came back off the line, and his friend came over, big guy. And he says, where's Frank? And I couldn't talk. And this another soldier was with me, and he said, he got it. That's what we used to say if somebody was killed. He got it. I couldn't say anything, but my friends said he got it. And the guy who was looking for Collins got this agonized look on his face. Face collapsed. And he wheeled around and ran away, crying.
Oh yeah.
It was like a scene in a movie. As I said in my memoir, some of the little scenes were like things in movies, like attacking through a graveyard. And that sounds preposterous, but we did it.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, soldiers don't just go on roads. They go, you know, in woods and all over the place. And one time we were waiting for an artillery barrage to stop so we could do our attack. And we usually on a line, you know, and it was just before dawn, and then the shelling stopped, and we moved forward, and it was a graveyard. We had to go through a graveyard.
Wow.
And that was right in front of us.
That's crazy.
That was like a scene from a movie. That was.
Wow. Well, in your memoir, you wrote, quote, later in life, I wondered if you are what you think you are, if you are the sum total of what everyone who knows you thinks you are, end quote. Could you kind of elaborate what you mean by that and the situation that kind of led you to that?
I always thought that, I never thought I was brave. I thought I was always, you know, trying to not to get killed, but I never put anybody else in any danger. And for a while, toward the end, I was responsible for a squad of about 6 or 7 guys. So I had to tell people where to go and what to do and things like that. But what were we starting out with? What would you ask? What did you ask me? What am I supposed to be talking about?
I know that you had mentioned that the thing that made you think that was that your general had elected you for a medal or something, or had wanted to.
Yeah, I wasn't a general, but I know what you were saying. I was surprised to learn that the lieutenant was looking for me. I found this out later, after the war. When my friend Moose told me this. And I said, why was he looking for me? And Moose said, I think he wanted to put you in for a decoration.
Wow.
And I don't know, and that's when I said, when I thought of that saying, you know, are you what you think you are, or are you the perception of all other people? You know, it's interesting because you can't really evaluate your own self. You can't.
Yeah.
You have to see what other people think and say about you.
Well, clearly people thought you were brave because it was 2009 that you got the French Legion of Honor, right?
Well, the French, that's very touching. Yeah.
What was that like?
That came from the president of France. He only gave out 10 of them.
Wow.
I mean, nobody else can give it out but him. And they call it, you're a chevalier. Chevalier, that means a knight.
Wow.
That's the thing. It says you're a chevalier of the Legion of Honor, and it's signed by the President of France. I got it in the room, and the certificate and the medal.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the French, as the years have gone by, the French have been more forthcoming with awards and appreciation. They never forgot.
Yeah.
Never forgot.
Kristen, for the listeners, that's my cousin, granddad's granddaughter. She told me about a time when she was out to dinner with you and grandma here in Winter Park, and you were thanked by a Frenchman who had remembered your division coming through his town.
Oh, could
you tell us about that experience?
Well, I have a jacket, a casual jacket. I could show it to you. It's in the closet. When we go out to dinner, I wear it a lot, and it's got a big, gaudy emblem on it that Yvonne sewed on, and it says something about Croix de Guerre. Oh, it says the American Order of the French Croix de Guerre. It's a big, gaudy. I could show you that thing. And somebody saw that in a restaurant. And when I went to pay my bill, leaving, the waiter said, no, it's been paid for. Somebody in the restaurant paid your bill. So you don't owe anything.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know who it was. Somebody was seeing that, and it meant something to him.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
And I've had people stop me and shake my hand.
Wow.
You know, in the airports and things, once in a while. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, did you ever think that would have happened when you were in the foxholes? I mean, it must be strange being recognized for your service so after the fact.
I just knew that if I survived, that I'd get a lot of attention when I mm-hmm. came home. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's inevitable. And when I did come home, you know, people were really interested in hearing about my adventures and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you took anything positive away from your experience?
Oh,
I mean,
sure. Well, there's a saying that, you know, infantry combat, you wouldn't do it for $1 million, but you wouldn't take $1 million not to have done it.
Mm.
That's a little paradox.
Yeah.
Saying. So, you know, there's nothing like it in terms of experiences. So I don't regret having had it.
If you were given a do-over, was there anything you would have changed about your experience?
No.
No.
No, not really.
How do you think World War II compares to the current war in Iraq and Afghanistan?
There's no comparison. You know, I have a saying, it shouldn't be called a war unless the other side is wearing steel helmets. I really believe that. Otherwise, there are people in pajamas or crazy hats. And then they're not real soldiers. They're civilians with guns, bathrobes. They wear bathrobes, for God's sake. They're not real soldiers. The Germans were soldiers, you know, tough bastards they were. But I just feel sorry for having to fight clowns like that.
Mm.
You know, these silly wars we get into. Vietnam with 8 years of nonsense.
Yeah.
50,000 dead for nothing. None of our business, we had no business being there. It doesn't make it, you know, sometimes governments just do stupid things. You know, Joan Baez, the folk singer,
yeah.
She said, just because the government's gone crazy doesn't mean I have to go crazy with it. You know, she would always say it against the war and stuff, you know, but nothing did any good. Nothing did any good. They, you know, it's just so damn thick. They just kept on with that war that lasted forever.
Yeah.
Silly. No point to it.
Was it hard watching that happen, being veteran at the time?
I just felt so sorry for the soldiers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had total sympathy. Then, God, in Vietnam, they were calling them baby killers, you know, because we fight these enemies that are Mickey Mouse soldiers, but they're very clever with propaganda. And they would take an occasional atrocity and build it up and make us look bad. Mm-hmm. And the soldiers are coming back and then being ignored or hissed at, you know. That's sad.
Yeah.
Poor buggers.
What kind of advice would you give to future generations?
Well, try to see, you're in the hands of politicians, and you want to avoid getting associated with crusaders and ideologues, people with agendas. They're a menace to go to war. They don't go themselves, though, but they would like other people to go.
Yeah.
I always tried not to vote for people I thought would be like that in office. But that's about all you can do. Be careful who you vote for.
I've noticed also that in your stories, you have a great admiration for the Germans as an enemy. What were they like? I mean, did you ever meet any in person?
Little things. After the war, in fact, Yvonne and I used to tour a lot. We don't do it anymore. Fortunately, we've been everywhere we want to be, but we were running out of gas. But there was a time we did a lot of touring, and we were touring in Louisiana, and we liked the tours where they'd have a lot of Europeans in them. We didn't like to just tour with other Americans. It's kind of boring. But when you have foreigners, it's interesting. You find out new stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so one time we encountered a couple with a daughter, a typical faithful daughter, totally fluent in English. Nice looking, too. She was about 25, something like that. And her daddy was with her. He was a World War II vet in the German army.
Wow.
And he spoke no English. Only German he spoke. So what they would do is, and she was totally fluent in those both languages. So she would listen to what was going on and tell him in German, and he would comment back to her in German. And we ran into them one time at a table, and we got sort of friendly. And then another time, Yvonne and I were at a little table, but there was just barely room for one or two other people at it, but nobody sat there because there was plenty of room. In comes the German guy and his daughter. I saw them enter the restaurant. They were late, and didn't see any place to sit. So I caught their eye, and I went like that. So they came over, we made room. They squeezed in on a little table, and we talked. And I told the daddy, it was a three-cornered conversation.
Yeah.
I told the girl that I was on the Western Front. She told that to her daddy. And then I said I was in Alsace-Lorraine mostly, infantry. Patton's army, and he got all that from her. Mm. Then he asked us, where were we going to go to next, touring? And we said, I said, Russia. And he, I got a reaction out of it. He said it to her, and then she had to tell me what he said. You know, he said, I walked all the way to Russia and all the way back, and I'll never go there again. Poor bugger. You know, that was an awful campaign, snow and ice. And they walked thousands of miles. And they turn around and went all the way back again. You know, just like Napoleon, same thing. Crazy. And he, that's what he said. I walked all the way to Russia. I don't want to go there again. And the daughter was just like an American girl. And she liked jazz. So, boy, that's a big deal with me.
Yeah.
So she told me she wanted to buy some CDs because she said they're only a third of the cost in the U.S. compared to buying them in Germany. I don't know why. Doesn't make any sense. So I said, I know there's a record store. We were in New Orleans, I guess that's where we were. I said, I've seen a couple of record stores. I said, if you like, I'll scope them out for you. And men always like to please women, you know. Pretty women, anyway.
Granddad, you charmer.
And I said, I could scope them out and tell you what they have. I felt a little sorry for her, you know, and she was pleased at that. So I did it. I went to a big record store, and I looked at all their stock, and I had took notes what I would buy. She told me she wanted to buy stuff because I said only one-third the cost. So I took notes of everything I would recommend for her to buy. It was mostly stuff I had myself, you know. So the next time we saw them, I told her what I'd done. She was delighted, and she wanted my notes and stuff. And I told her where the place was. But then I'm kind of cynical in some ways. I figured that'll be the last I ever hear that.
Yeah.
I figured she'll never follow through. She was just being polite, you know. But by God, the next time I saw them, She'd done the very thing she said she was going to do. She went to that record store and bought all the things that I'd written down.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I was very pleased at that. I couldn't believe it. People usually don't do what they say they're going to do.
Yeah.
But she did.
So you don't have, from all the times that I've talked to you, you don't seem to have any animosity at all, really, towards, like, Germans or Japanese whatsoever.
No.
But some veterans do. I mean, do you know anyone like that, or why do you think they hold those prejudices?
Well, at the time of the war, I really hated the Japanese. Everybody did, because they were mean, ruthless. And bullies, they were bullies. You know, they really, the image they have now is the total opposite of what the image they had during the war, the men anyway. But then, in fact, I had a friend who was in the Marines, in the island fighting the Japanese, awful bastards. They would, if they ever caught you, they'd cut up pieces of you and throw them out of the foxholes to torment the other Americans. That's the things they would do things like that.
Oh my God.
They're savages. That's why they were hated so. And he would not go in a room if there was a Japanese person in it.
Wow.
And we were always teaching foreign visitors, including Japanese, and he would not participate if there was any Japanese. He hated them.
Oh my gosh.
And he died. He died shortly after retiring, and I think, and he was only, you know, around 60, and I think he died young from that damn war, fighting the Japanese. He hated them so. He was a captain in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
So I never had any animosity toward the Germans. I had a little respect. And I liked some of their little ways. Like, if they had a minefield, they'd mark it. They'd put a little sign with a skull and crossbones that said mining.
What?
But I thought that was civilized. It, you know, they'd they'd hammer it down in the front of the minefield, and you knew if you kept going that way, you'd be in it.
Oh my gosh.
But that's what they did. They always marked their minefield. They didn't show you where the mines were, but the general area, they marked it. This is going to be mined here.
Wow.
So, you know, you got to think twice if you want to. Then we would have mine sweepers guys go with the long things, you know, like people do on the beach.
Yeah.
Looking for mines. But then the damn Germans, they're so clever. They'd have wooden ones, wooden things.
Oh, my God.
That wouldn't show up on a mine detector. They called them shoe mines. A friend of mine stepped on one and blew his foot off.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They tried to save the foot. He was full with his foot for a year and a half. And they finally gave up. They had to take the foot off.
Oh, my gosh.
And they tried to save it. But it was too far gone, stepping on that damn shoe mine.
Yeah.
But I respected the Germans, and I never heard anything bad of what they did. I mean, you know, they were crazy against the poor Jews, but the soldiers were all right. And they had a very strict posture toward civilians, behavior. They insisted on correct behavior by their troops. No rough stuff or bullying or anything like that. Very correct behavior. They were better than us, I thought. I mean, we would break things. We didn't give a damn. You know? We'd spoil some things. We'd wash clothes in springs, which, you know, by mistake. They would never do a thing like that. They would always find out, you know, where could they wash their clothes and stuff. So, you know, and their philosophy, they're funny. If you keep your nose clean and don't bother them and don't harass them, they leave you alone. That's their method, you know. And so the poor buggers in Normandy, the French civilians, they had a modus vivendi with the Germans. They kept their nose clean. They didn't harass them. They did what they were told. And the Germans left them alone. So their lives hardly changed at all.
Wow.
But that's the way the Germans were. They didn't make you say Heil Hitler or any of this stuff. But they wouldn't take any nonsense. Mm. I mean, if you harassed them or, God forbid, shot one of them, they would have bad reprisals. I mean, they'd take 20 Frenchmen, kill them, you know, put the fear of God in the populace. Mm. They were very severe, giving out the punishment. But if you kept your nose clean, they let you alone. That was the way they operated.
Yeah. Just one last question. We're right now in my granddad's house, and there's a huge wall of books behind him, and a lot of them are about World War II. Is it weird reading books about World War II, having been there? I mean, do people ever get things wrong? Do you ever learn things about it?
It's a fascinating subject, you know. And I like to get some of the British books, for example, to get the British viewpoint on D-Day and all. You know, I don't just get the American books. The Americans tend to brag a lot. We brag. And the British are more restrained, you know, stiff upper lip, and they don't brag. And, you know, I like to read about it. And some of these generals, like Montgomery, to me is insufferable. The British General Montgomery. Mm-hmm. He never did a damn thing right, I don't think. But he's got a big reputation because they didn't have anybody else. You know, they didn't have any real good generals. Where we had Patton and other competent generals. But Patton was the star we had. The only general the Germans feared.
Wow.
They weren't scared of, afraid of any other of them, but they were afraid of him. He was too unpredictable. Wow. He loved war like them.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for letting me interview. Is there anything that we've left out or anything you feel you want to add?
The one regret I've always had is that the Army didn't do more to rotate divisions, to give divisions a rest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They kept you fighting and forever. You know? They just didn't, they could never figure out what to do to keep a division in good fighting trim. You know, after a while, you lose your elan, you lose your edge of combat efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get half wacky. So they can't just keep you up there forever. People crack, you know. If you're there too long, you just crack. No matter who you are. So they were not good at that. They just leave the poor divisions up there until they virtually disintegrated. And they wasted a lot of manpower. Too many jerks in the rear echelon. The German army was much more efficient. smaller divisions, they'd have 10,000 men in a division. Most of them would be fighting. Yeah. We'd have 15,000 men and probably 4,000 fighting.
Wow.
Just wasted manpower. I hope that we learn. But I heard a colonel give a speech once on that very theme, what I just talked about. He knew that was the problem. But I just wondered if he ever had any success convincing the higher ups.
Well, thank you so much, Granddad.
You're really welcome. Enjoyed
listening to your story.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.